Welcome, listeners. Time for an awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your host, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com. That's timeforawakening.com, which is home base, and listen to the live stream there. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and listen to the live stream from that location. Or you can download TuneIn on any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. You can download TuneIn to your device, and in the search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening, and you'll see the icon, and you can listen, you can stream the program live, even into your car. That's Time for an Awakening with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. That's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening has a fan page on Facebook also. You can log into that Facebook search engine and type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting articles being posted daily. And before you leave that page, do me a favor and hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for Awakening Media, which is home base, is also there. It should be one of your favorites. If not, put that in your address bar and make it one of your favorites. That's timeforawakening.com. That's timeforawakening.com. Will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. There you'll see more interesting content and the podcasts of the programs that you can download, listen at a later time, even share with your friends. So again, make that one of your favorites and put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, this Friday evening, we're in open form. Anything on your mind, you can give us a call on this, what we've been labeling it, Freestyle Friday. Just give us a call, 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. Before we go into open form, we scheduled to have a special guest join us briefly to talk about some historical tours that he's conducting here in the Philadelphia area, and that's Philadelphia black historian, Mr. Joe Becton, is scheduled to be with us to give us an update. But we'll be right back to get things started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
Not a All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started this evening, I'd like to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch. Brother Richard is with us on the line. Brother Richard.
How you doing? How you doing there, Elliot?
How you feel, sir?
I'm feeling good. This has been an interesting week, and we're past the festivities of the colonizers and arbitrators of a new nation state on their 4th of July, dealing with other. They call threats and development, and in our community, some real questions on what we have to do. So I like that we're moving forward.
Well, we're in open forum this evening, so we'll touch on some of those issues that you kind of skirted on just a minute ago. we're supposed to have an update from a Philadelphia historian, one of our elders, Mr. Joe Backton. Will be with us, scheduled to join us. He wants to give us a little update on some historical tours that he has going on around the Philadelphia area. If you want to know anything about Black Philadelphia, the history of Black Philadelphia and Black people in this area, and we've been here in Pennsylvania and in Philadelphia almost as long as Europeans, two people that I know of that knows everything about that is Mr. Charles Blockson and Mr. Joe Backton.
Yes, that's true, and definitely is a treat to have. I shouldn't say treat; it's an informative experience as always. You know, Joe just had got a recognition at Eden Cemetery around the work that he's done in relationship to continuing that historical recognition of Africans in Philadelphia, whether it be a colonial Philadelphia. Or even during the Civil War, being a officer in the Civil War reenactment troop, so I believe it's the 3rd Regiment. So it's and Joe is interesting, not just interesting, but a great teacher in relationship to being able to pull this together and package it for us to be able to look at how our story can be as much a part of an economic enterprise in relationship to doing historical tours. And I hope that's something that in every city that people recognize that our story is not just something that we should feel celebrating, whatever, but it's something that we should share, but it also has the potential of being a enterprise that can provide us with job fulfillment, entrepreneurial activities and interests, as Joe is doing with Becton Tours.
And again, I just want to make mention, and I just made it a second ago, but our guest has joined us. And whenever you want to know about the history of black people in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia in particular, two men that are foremost authorities, Mr. Charles Boxton, and the other is with us on the line here, is Mr. Joe Becton. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for letting me come on to speak tonight. And thank you, you know, for all that wonderful introduction. Richard, man, that's great. Wow. Thank you. But yes, I'm glad to have a chance to talk with people tonight. Tomorrow, I'm doing my fifth annual, I call it Joe Becton's Revolutionary Walking Tour. So this is the fifth year that has gone on. We walk a while. So those of you who came with me last month when I did my short history tour, that was 2 hours. So this one, we'll have a break after 2 hours, and then we'll go two more. It's downtown Philadelphia. The essence of the discussion is that we, as the African Americans, are the ones who define freedom. So that's the essence of the discussion. The Declaration of Independence, of course, doesn't talk about the freedom. It talks about those men, all men, but it doesn't talk about freedom. Constitution, of course, nobody even listens to that because it says really nothing about freedom. It's an administrative document. So we're going to take this walk, go by some of the buildings, talk about some of the people who helped reframe these things and have a feeling for what freedom really meant. One of my favorite quotes is, independence is not freedom. And, of course, you know, we will be talking about the time that Fred Douglass stopped by Independence Hall in September of 1844 and talk about some of his comments. You know, I think that Fred Douglass and Sojourner Truth were kind of always at the edge, at odds, you know, because Fred, he could read and he knew all these people. Sojourner didn't, but she still could see right through the Constitution that it had some boll weevils in it. So there's a lot of great discussions, a few songs that we'll be singing when we were walking around. One of the great musicians at that time was a guy named Frank Johnson, so we'll be stopping by his place and, you know, recalling some of his music. For those of you who know some, you know I'm a musician, too. I have my harmonica out there. Won't be dragging the guitar, but we'll have my harmonica and my flute. So we'll be, you know, singing some songs and reviewing some ideas of the old Philadelphia musician. So, like I said, this is starting at 10 o'clock, 6 in Market. $20 for adults, $5 for children, and I say it'll be an experience that you'll never forget. We've been having a reenactment right in the middle of it.
Mr. Becton, you see a lot of things going on in Philadelphia, and they're happening simultaneously. The gentrifying of the city, the kind of whitewashing of the history here in the city, because as I mentioned before you came on, and you can speak to this more than anybody, is that when you're talking about Pennsylvania and Philadelphia in particular, our history in forming the city was just as important or may have been more important than the Europeans here. But when you talk about tours and historical tours, the larger public knows nothing about the African-American experience or contribution here in the city. And I don't know, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, whether any historical tours are even steered towards you, yourself or Mr. Bloxon or anybody else. Talk about that as far as some of these tourist dollars not being funneled towards African-Americans.
But you know, you've got a very interesting and pertinent question. I'm born and raised in Philadelphia, but as a child, I was, just like most teenagers, tied up in what the teenagers felt was happening. I went away and came back from the Marines, and at that point, then I started to say, well, what is this story? What is going on here? You know, the boys wrote the Philadelphia Negro, and so actually that's where I started, right there with Du Bois and the Philadelphia Negro. That was a sociological study, but it's set right around 1900, and it gave us a kind of a panoramic view of what, as he called it, Negro Philadelphia looked like at that point. So that was very enlightening for me, and that really brought me into it. Of course, right after his time, of course, is when the Negro History Digest and the Negro Journal, History Journal, they came out too, and that's Carter's work, right? So there's a line of, if you will, black historians from Du Bois to Carter to Wesley. He was the director of the African-American, Charles Wesley to Charles Blockson, and then, you know, hopefully to people like, oh, come on, Joe, how dare you? Jackie Wiggins and Dr. Parham and, of course, Mr. Blockson and hopefully myself. There is a line of people who have been doing this, and that's I won't say it's an unbroken line, but there is a certain line. Now, when it comes to economics, that's when everything gets really, really tricky in Philadelphia, as you know. You know, one time, Society Hill, as we call it, used to be a black and poor neighborhood. You know, and they just came through with the big scam and gave everybody a couple $1,000s to move. And maybe two decades later, everything's worth $500,000.
Okay.
So this is a trend that's going on all over America. We look at cities like New York City and Washington, D.C., and we can, it's just like happens right before our eyes. The people who grew up along Flatbush Avenue, I guess that's Brooklyn, and places like that, the people who grew up there 20, 30 years ago can't afford to move back there because the prices have just zoomed up. And, of course, a new group is coming in, an economic group, definitely, and maybe even a racial group. So a new group's coming in. We see the same thing in Northwest Washington. The houses, you know, 10 years ago were $40,000, $50,000. Now they're worth $150,000. And it's almost like in the blink of an eye. So we're seeing that same thing going on all over Philadelphia. Oh, what was I talking to somebody just the other day? Atlantic City. I was saying, well, you certainly must be able to get a cheap house in Atlantic City. They said, no, the city is tearing down every house. So we've seen that go on in Philadelphia, too, where the city just comes by and tears entire blocks out. So, yes, they're on the move. And I guess this is what you call a modernization of a city. My big concerns are, you know, the sense of community. I mean, do we have communities here? That a lot of people say our communities are not good, but I don't know. They're not members of them, so I'm not sure if we can take their critique. Okay. But we have communities. Sometimes they're weak. Sometimes they're strong. But with this new movement, what's going to happen to communities? Communities used to be surrounded around religious organizations. So we have some of that stuff going on. You know, some places over here in West Philly, we have kind of an Islamic center that's building up right over here between 46th and 42nd Street. And, of course, there's the many churches, the Sharon's churches, Baptist churches, things like that. The AME over 43rd Street. So there's a lot of religious centers to help hold the community together. But, you know, well, what happens when those religious centers are gone? At one time, the First Baptist used to be down on Vine Street. And of course, now what's on Vine Street? The highway that runs right through there and some of the most expensive property in town. So,
or even the church that Marian Anderson went to the byway of redevelopment.
Really? Was that the one she attended or the one
attended.
That she attended? Oh, okay. Okay.
But, you know, Joe, the thing in relationship to what you're saying and the question about historians and community-developed historians and this being an audience where we have communities all across the country and in different areas, how important work that you're doing, not just as a person who can be able to tell a story, but a person who can be able to package the story so those of us or the general community at large can come in and be willing to share in their dollars to be able to hear so that they can be able to be more informed about that. One of the major points that you made, what freedom is as it relates as Africans in this case, Philadelphia. How do you see that that's a project that will continue to the tourist aspect, the business of tourism will continue to develop?
And yes, I do. When I finished my college back in 1980, it took me a couple of years to return to Philadelphia in 83. And when I got here, there was one lady who was leading a tour. She was a Haitian woman. We called her Miss Dijon, and her husband was always with her. He was the colonel. Now, I don't know what the colonel I don't know what the colonel did in Haiti or anything like that, but they had a nice, I guess we called a condo at 2nd and Lombard, right across the street from the head house, you know. So these are, you know, people of African descent, Haitians, right? She spoke French and she spoke English, and she gave Black History tours to Center City, Philadelphia. So she was the first one that I met when I returned at the course in the conception of the African American Museum. They also offered a tour that went around Center City. I actually wasn't here for that one because I think they opened in 76, and I was in college in 76, 77. I moved to Florida. So I never saw that tour, but I actually do have a map of the tour that they offered out of the African American. So there have been things here before, and I've sprung an interest. I think that that what's going on in Philadelphia is that we're getting more and more people who are interested in just coming to Philadelphia. You know, they don't know they know the movies and they know the ball games and maybe the Broken Bell. Once again, those community organizations like the AME Church, when they bring a conference here with their new statues and their new work and libraries and archives, that's going to bring more and more people here. So I think, and I'm hoping, that we're going to have that reputation for being that kind of place. You know, Dr. Bloxon has already laid the groundwork for us, you know, identifying various sites on the Underground Railroad, because that's where, I mean, our story for freedom, you know, begins in the very beginning with Anthony Johnson arguing to own property in the 1600s. But, you know, it really heats up right around the 1820s, 1830s, when the riots start to come in and we start to react to those riots and the rise of the Seminole Nations. And so it really, really gets tight around the 1830s, and that's when we really start to see us coming out and defining what freedom is. As the Indians join our community, because the only good Indian is dead. And so we just start to just open up. You know, our AME churches start to pop up everywhere, educational institutions like Institute for Colored Youth. So in the 1830s, we really start to pop in Philadelphia and around America. Of course, that the movie that was just out, the Birth of a Nation movie, talking about Nat Turner, that was right there in the 1830s. So this, when the whole thing is really... Well, it's starting to overflow, that it can't contain itself.
You know, Mr. Becton, let me, you know what, I want to ask you some questions and get your opinion on it, being an historian. But what we'll do, we'll take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation.
Thank you so much.
Sir. No, stay with us. Stay with us.
I will.
And you can get involved, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're talking to Philadelphia Black historian, Mr. Joe Becton, and we'll be right back.
Tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Hey, did y'all see the stuff I posted on my wall?
No, it didn't even show up in my news feed.
Man, I'm done with social media. All the injustice and brutality going around, and it's like they're trying to suppress our voice. We're trying to get the message out there, and you can't even share empowerment and what's going on around the country either.
Nah, don't be dumb with social media, though. It's a tool, and there is a place where we have a voice. It's a Let's Buy Black 365 social network. You do anything you want on any other social network. Post pictures, videos, status updates, share resources and community news. But on Let's Buy Black 365, it's a platform for us and by us to tell our messages.
Whoa, that's like a digital underground railroad.
What's the name of that site again?
It's letsbuyblack365.com.
Yeah, I heard about that. It's all about networking, and you get points, right?
Yeah, the more you network, post, and share, the more points you get. Plus, you get points for posting pictures, sharing information, attending community events, and inviting others to network with you on the app.
Wow, that's all I need to know. I'm gonna go download that app right now.
Now, better yet, let me invite you so I can get some points. It's all about empowerment and solutions, y'all.
Yeah, that's what's up. I'm all in.
Let's do it. Let's share our stories.
Let's buy Black365.com.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Back to time for an awakening. And we're in conversation this evening with Philadelphia, Black Philadelphia historian. Mr. Joe Becton is with us this evening to kind of give us an update on some upcoming tours that he has planned, and also just to conversate on the history of our people here in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania in particular. Mr. Becton.
Yes, yes.
Before we left for break, I'd like to ask you a question, because, you know, you've done historical tours, you've done research on our ancestors that's been here, it's almost as long as Europeans, and have developed this Philadelphia area into what it is basically today. Talk about, because during the period of Richard Allen, you had people like Richard Allen, James Fortune, that was in that same era. And you can correct me if I'm wrong. You had later on, you had a man like Martin Delaney, who was from the Pittsburgh area, and Frederick Douglass, who was around during the same time period. Now, James Fortune he was a relatively wealthy man for a black man during that period. He had a shipping company. Okay, and he was willing to take, he had a nationalist mentality. Now, Richard Allen did to a certain extent, but I think Richard Allen wanted our people to be free in the society where we were. James Fortune might have had a little more of a pan-African worldview, similar to Martin Delaney and Frederick Douglass. Talk about their views as far as you understand it, and give me your opinion on what they would think of our people now.
Wow, okay, that's a big one. Hey, let's go back right to the beginning, you know.
Go ahead.
1644, there's a guy named Antonio. He's been sold by the Spanish to this Swedish governor in what we would call Delaware County. So 1644, this African Antonio steps on the ground in what we would call Essington, Pennsylvania today. That's one of the first Africans that we can identify living in Philadelphia, connected once again with a governor, but nonetheless, in the 1600s when this happens too, so 1644. So now sometimes people get a little edgy with me and they say, well, if you don't like where you're at, why don't you go back where you came from? And of course, I always like to remind them that my people have been here since 1644 and, you know, when did your people arrive? So that's a very, very important realization, you know, that, you know, before William Penn arrived here, Africans like me were here and we were doing things. So when we begin to put together that contribution from 1644 all the way today, it's an amazing contribution. I always like to capsulize it by saying from the slave house to the city hall. And just an amazing story of success and overcoming every possible option and objective, the religious organizations, the financial. I mean, America was about making money, but we couldn't make money. I mean, so every possible block that was in the way was in the way. You couldn't be a member of your own family. So these guys and women beat down every one of those blocks. Until today, we can actually say it's not unusual to have a black mayor of Philadelphia. Now, what they're doing, that may be something else, but it's not unusual to have one. So now let's go into that 1700s piece, because all those guys that you mentioned knew each other or by connection knew each other.
Okay.
So the first one is the oldest one. His name's Absalom Jones. And so Absalom Jones, he's enslaved. He's here in Philly with a guy named Wynkoop. And Absalom Jones saved up his money, and instead of buying rum, he bought books. How ingenious was that, huh? So he began to learn how to read and write, and with that, he also came to Philadelphia and clicked in, I believe, with the Quaker Anthony Benezet, where he was introduced to counting and numbers. Now, the Episcopalians would teach a black man how to read and write so he could read the Bible, but they didn't like to teach you how to count because what did that have to do with the Bible? And, of course, counting is essential to being in business and operating on any kind of scale.
Mm-hmm.
He learned how to read and write and count, and the guy made him a clerk, but he refused to sell him his freedom. Ultimately, he would go out and buy his wife, Mary, buy her a home, and the guy was okay with all that, but still would never sell Absalom himself his freedom. So Absalom is here in Philly when the British come capture the city. It's like, yeah, come on, let's go. We can go. You can be free. Get away from these clowns. Absalom Jones was a pacifist. You know, that's another part of this story that we never hear. You know, we hear about African men who were crazed, who were murderers. No, Absalom Jones was a pacifist. Believed in peace, did not believe in war, would not join in with the British, nor the Americans. So there's Absalom Jones. Now, James Fortune, he's a young kid during this time, but he does believe in war. James Warden goes out on a Navy ship, actually a privateer. You know, some people would call it a pirate, actually. But he goes out on a privateer and makes a couple of good scores, and then eventually gets captured, ends up in a British prison ship in New York, the Hope, Jersey. So he's still a young kid. He's like 16, 17 years old. Absalom Jones is a grown man at this point. When the war ends, Absalom Jones is finally freed. The guy finally gets the right to buy his freedom. James Wharton comes back and begins to set up that sales shop. They both know each other because they're going to get together and try to create a church called the St. Thomas's Episcopal Church. Yeah, so those guys know each other very, very well as they build that Episcopal Church. Richard Allen, he knows them too, and of course he's there where for the Great Walkout. Probably one of the biggest events in Philadelphia history happens at St. George's Methodist Church. Absalom Jones, Richard Allen, William White, and a number of other African-Americans have become members of the Methodist Church. They like the Methodists. I mean, the Methodists make a joyful noise. They sing. They shout. Sometimes they fall out. You know, the Methodists. Yeah, they like the Methodists. But as long as everything was outside, along the creek side, what do we call those group meetings? Yeah, but as long as everything was outside, it was cool.
Mm-hmm.
When they moved inside, then you had to have the white section, the black section, the female section, and then they start, you know, moving the sections around. So one morning they came in and they had moved their section. For those of you who go to church, you know what that means. You go to church, you've been there, your mother was there, your grandmother was there, they sat in the same seat 20, 30 years. You come in one day and somebody says, "We're moving your seat." Well, quite naturally, it was a major uproar, and with that, Absalom Jones said that you'll be bothered by us no more. And they walked out and went on to create the AME and the AE, St. Thomas's African Episcopal. So, I mean, just a major thing that happened right there, 4th Street. Every once in a while, they talk about it there in the church. But it's one of those things that you could actually pass through that church. Oh, by the way, the church is actually called the Birthplace of American Methodism. So when you talk about us as a people being at the foundation of everything, we are. How's that for some connections?
Okay. Now, let's break, because you drew the connection there between James Fortune, Absalom Jones, and Richard Allen. Let's talk about the connection coming up a few years later between Frederick Douglass and Martin Delaney. It's clear that Martin Delaney was a early Pan-Africanist.
Absolutely. Martin Delaney and Blyden, the other brother named Blyden, who was a big Pan-African. Martin Delaney, of course.
Give me his whole name.
Tomorrow, I believe, you know, going back to Africa, up the Niger River, and finding the area that he said was good for us to populate. It was, just amazing. So when he comes back in 59, they stop him at the Royal Statistical Society in London. He gets to speak in there. He begins his speech, and the American delegate to Great Britain just gets up, storms out. He's not standing here listening to this Negro. So he walked out. But the British were very interested in his report about the Upper Niger River. Now, before he went to the Upper Niger River, he and Fred Douglass used to work together. Martin Delaney had his own newspaper called The Mystery out in Pittsburgh. And Fred Douglass's newspaper, of course, was in Rochester, New York, the North Star. So for a while, I believe as much as 2 years, Delaney was actually the editor for the North Star. Now, there was a... Anyway, you know, this stuff is...
Wait a minute. Hold it. Hold it, Mr. Becton. From what I understand, what they teach, that William Lloyd Garrison was the editor of the North Star.
William Lloyd Garrison is the editor of The Liberator.
Okay.
The Liberator.
Okay.
He has his own newspaper out of Boston, The Liberator. And, of course, you know, if we want to go in that direction, of course, James Fortin was influential and substantial, financially responsible for getting that Liberator up and off the ground.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's that connection coming from Philadelphia. What he did was sell advanced subscriptions to the magazine.
Okay.
And with that money, William Lloyd Garrison, the white guy, was able to get the Liberator up and going. So he's the editor of The Liberator. Fred Douglass has his, The North Star. those two guys eventually bump heads, right? Because, well, who's the real leader of the movement? Is it Fred? Or is it William Lloyd Garrison? William Lloyd Garrison keeps telling Fred, calm down, shut up, sit down for a minute. And Fred won't sit down. He's just everywhere, doing everything. So it's, from my perspective, it looks like an ego battle. It's who really has the, you know, who's the biggest, who's the best, who's the baddest. You know, Fred Douglas, even though he trains under William Lloyd Garrison for a bit, breaks away relatively soon and goes on his way. Martin Delaney, I think Fred went to England or did something like that, and Martin Delaney decided that he didn't want to be in his organization anymore. So Martin Delaney moves on. I mean, tremendous, you know, by the time we get to the Civil War, right? So Fred, Martin Delaney has gone to Africa, come back, and said, Fred, I found this wonderful place. Fred said, okay, it sounds wonderful, but I already see black country, Haiti.
Mr. Becker?
The first free black country, Haiti.
Okay.
And, of course, around that time, that's when the Civil War breaks out. Martin Delaney and Fred Douglas both become recruiters for the Union, of course, and they recruit Martin Delaney, at least one regiment. Fred Douglas looks like three regiments, two in Massachusetts, one in Connecticut. And, of course, everywhere that they went, they were recruiting and encouraging people to join. Martin Delaney actually ends up with a rank of major in the United States Army, probably the highest-ranking guy in the United States Army up to that point. There was a guy in North Carolina who was a North Carolina militia named Henderson, and he made lieutenant colonel. But because it was a North Carolina regiment and not a federal regiment, we never talk about him as being a lieutenant colonel in the federal army, but he was for the Union. So, yeah, those guys are back and forth at it all the time. Martin Delaney, it seems to me, though, keeps it kind of cool. I know Sojourner Truth overtly attacks Fred on numerous occasions. So there's tension between the different, what should we call them, celebrities.
And that's, you know what, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because that's one thing that I've never seen, you know, just, I'm not an authority on history as yourself, but that's one thing I've never really seen just looking at history where any of them really sniped at one another. But you're saying that once in a while this happened?
Oh, yes. There's one of the guys that I do an impression of is named Samuel Burris. And a couple of the guys here in town, Robert Purvis, William Still, these guys, they kind of like had educational lessons. They taught them about abolition. I guess if you had never thought about freedom, the idea that freedom was something that naturally belonged to everybody would be very foreign, you know. So they literally had to be schooled. I think it was the famous female abolitionist, Katie Stanton, who did time schooling some of the new abolitionists. Well, later on we find out, you know, Katie Stanton is screaming and hollering when black men get the right to vote before women. But, I mean, I guess from her perspective, she trained some of them to be abolitionists to prepare for that moment. And then when the moment came, they didn't vote for women votes. But, yes, these guys are, in a very real way, celebrities. And once you look more into Fred's life, he's almost like a rock star. Right now, at this point, they're saying that he is one of the most photographed people of the 19th century. Mm. So, you know, he, you know, we're really, as time goes on, we're really getting the impression that he was really super famous.
Mr. Becton, what was the impression of some of our ancestors in Philadelphia, for example, when they were hearing what happened in regards to Nat Turner's Rebellion, Gabriel Prosser, things of that nature? What was their responses, and how did they get information? Because when you talk about Martin Delaney having a newspaper, Frederick Douglass with the North Star, you know, when we think about newspapers now, you know, you think about reporters going to locations, giving reports, things of that nature. We know that there was no black reporters going to different areas reporting on what was going on. So how did they get the stories? How did they get the information? How did they pass it along? How did our people find out what happened down there in Virginia, in Jerusalem, Virginia, with Nat Turner and some of the other elders?
Well, you know what? I'm thinking that in a Nat Turner event, that there was good coverage in the regular papers, you know, that the murders happened, that they caught him, that they killed him. You know, I don't think we got any really good information on the Nat Turner thing till the books of the 1960s, the Confessions of Nat Turner, the 13 Confessions of Nat Turner.
Okay.
I don't think we got any good information on it until then. You know, and so there's a block that's going on. 2 years before Nat Turner is when the brother wrote the book.
David Walker.
Yes, thank you, David Walker. Mm-hmm. David Walker. You know, when you read David Walker's book to the colored residents of America, the bottom line is, let God sort it out. He's like saying, total revolution. So David Walker did this 2 years writing, 2 years before Nat Turner. At the same time this is going on, the Seminole Wars are breaking out all over Florida. You know, so, I mean, there's fighting in Florida. There's the riots that are going on in the cities, because now the inner city people, what do we call them? Know-nothings is what we call them. They got another name, too. Yeah, well, let's go with know-nothings for a minute. So we call them know-nothings. They're rioting all over the place. They're attacking the Irish, the new immigrants. So these know-nothings that tend to be German and English, even though a lot of the historians try to push it on the Irish. But they really wouldn't go down there and just burn up their own neighborhood, you know, just to kill themselves. Scots Irish might, but not the regular Irish. So there's this anti-thing against the Irish. In the 1830s, they start changing all the documentation. They start telling the Black Revolutionary War soldiers they were not there because there were no blacks fighting on the American side of the Revolution. So people are losing their pensions. People are losing their land bounties. The riots are all over the place. Of course, this is right around the time that they're going to what? They're going to remove the five civilized tribes, Creek, Choctaw, Chickasaw, Cherokee, and Seminole, right? So so all this is going on at the same time. Andrew Jackson is the president, kind of leading this whole kind of kind of similar time to now, kind of leading this kind of whole kind of thing about the only good Indian is a dead Indian. They all need to move to Oklahoma. We stop the importation of Africans because we're growing our own Africans and selling them into the South so that we can start this whole cotton industry. So from the sugar industry to the tobacco industry to the cotton industry. So what are they thinking? They're scrambling. They're fighting. James Fortin wrote his first letter of a colored citizen back in 1813. So almost as soon as we came out of the war of 1812, they were trying to take our rights away from us. In Pennsylvania, African-Americans had the right to vote until 1838. All you had to be was a property owner, and you had the right to vote. Well, they got rid of that in 1838. 1840, come on, you know his name. His name is Purvis. Robert Purvis writes the letter of 40,000, where he explains to the Pennsylvania legislators, how dare you? Our blood, this soil has been nurtured with the blood of our ancestors, and you come along and take away our right to vote. So we're writing, we're fighting, we're escaping. Of course, this is the time period where everybody usually say the Underground Railroad came up. Of course, I know and believe and teach that the Underground Railroad, you know, was all about the fight, all about the struggle, and the struggle began on the ships like the Amistad and then the Creole and the Antelope, so we can document them fighting on new ships, sometimes successfully taking over the ships. You know, so I say that struggle begins on the ships, and then we just see it echoed and reverberated in the 1830s when everything, I might have said that already today, where everything starts to fall apart.
Okay.
That's one thing, Joe, that challenges me when we talk about, and you hear a lot in Philadelphia area and Pennsylvania area, or at least coming up from Virginia up about the Underground Railroad or the abolitionists, that there's not a lot. Every time we say abolition, we think of white, even sometimes for this area, Quakers or benevolent whites who are trying to assist Africans in their freedom. But like you said, the Africans has always been moving on their own volition for freedom. So do you think that through having tours that we're able to assist in not correcting, but providing a narrative where you give Black people their own agency in relationship to the freedom compared to just, I ain't saying without support, but not primarily the cause when we're talking about abolitionists and in the quest for freedom?
Well, of course, you know, that is the most pertinent part of the whole thing, is that normally when you look at the history of Africans, it's like, oh, that ain't our history. Oh, no, get out of here. But with this abolition thing, now there's a positivity that can be brought to the table. Everybody didn't own slaves. Everybody didn't rape Africans. Everybody didn't own sugar. Everybody didn't. Okay, so now that sense of a positive connection is making the Underground Railroad itself very positive. Now, what I found when I first came to Philadelphia, by the way, when I first came to Philadelphia, I didn't believe in the Underground Railroad. I didn't believe in that at all. Mr. Blockson looked at me like, what? He said, you got a lot to learn. But I didn't believe in it at all. I mean, every house you went to, they said, yeah, this house used to be on the Underground Railroad. Come down here in the cellar. I'll show you this space. Here's a little tunnel. Just the concept that all these houses were on the Underground Railroad, there would be nobody left in slavery. So in the beginning, I never believed it. About 2000, 1999, I was given an assignment to find the Underground Railroad among the signers of the Declaration and stuff like that. And I told the guy quite plainly, he said, that's not going to happen. These people were slave owners. They were not abolitionists. Come to find out, right there at Fifth Street and Arch, where the Mint is, that's where William Still's office was. That's where the Pennsylvania Anti-Slavery Society met. Right there at 3rd and, come on, you could say it, 4th and Chestnut. That's where Anthony Bennett's at, the wild Quaker lived who believed in education females. So what turned out was that I was so blind by that first generation of guys and the stuff that they did that I wasn't ready to see the second and third generations and how they came in. Mr. Blockson has said that we need to make sure we don't over-Quaker the Quakers. You know, the Quakers had a split in the society because some were considered themselves radical and couldn't continue with slavery. The Hicksites were part of the Quakers who were radical, who worked toward ending slavery, maybe operated on the Underground Railroad. So he always says, don't over-Quaker the Quakers. let's see. Over Quaker than Quakers. But the bottom line was that there was places all over Philadelphia, you know, where these activities were going on, Fourth and Brown, everywhere, you know.
The point is, though, the African Americans in Philadelphia, and I would assume other cities, they were very instrumental in the support of moving or assisting those people who were running away or gaining their freedom compared to just those white, when in some cases they say Quakers or you know, and I'm just trying to see if you agree that the Black abolitionism had a primary role more than a secondary role and assisting, and even if it's with their relationships with the other whites and elite, white elites or white religious leaders in the city.
Yes, absolutely. It's, of course, Benjamin Quarles actually put the book out, The Black Abolitionist, where he felt that this was going too far. So this was back in the 1960s when he wrote that. He felt it was going too far then. So as he came back in, Quarles was one of the instructors at Morgan State University. Absolutely. The Vigilance Committees of Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Vigilance Committee, the Joshua Levitt Committee, all these committees are dominated by Black people. I think it was McKim who said that it's basically the work of among the Negroes, you know, that they maybe sent some dollars here, some dollars there, but the day-to-day ground pound, dragging people around, Samuel Burris. Come on, you know her name. Harriet Tubman. I mean, these people are the ones who are the leaders and the activists inside it.
And Stephen Smith, his role in being able to assist.
Stephen Smith put his own railroad car, he and William Whipper. So it seems as though they would transport people in their railroad car from Columbia here to Philadelphia and then put them on their next leg on to freedom. So, yeah. I live on the Stephen Smith grounds, as a matter of fact.
Mr. Becton, tell me. Oh, go ahead, Richard.
No, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Tell me, when the Fugitive Slave Act was passed, I think in 1850 or early 1850s, how did our people react, our ancestors react up here in Philadelphia? Did we form, because we already had organizations formed at that time. Did the organizations come together to protect themselves? Because, you know, the Fugitive Slave Act, you had whites running all over and just kidnapping people and taking them to the South, similar to what happened Solomon Northrop. So you had a lot of that going on. Did our people organize with vigilantes to protect the community? What happened? Give us, our listeners, a dynamic.
Okay, well, one thing, remember there are actually two Fugitive Slave Acts. The first one in 1793, passed into law right here in Philadelphia, right there, 6th and Chestnut, at Congress Hall. That's right. So the first Fugitive Slave Act, and yes, it made the Fugitive Slave Act made it open season on Africans. You know, as early as the time of Richard Allen, two guys went to his house, knocked on the door, says, "Your name, Dick." They threw chains on him, dragged him out the door, and took him to the Walnut Street prison. If it hadn't been Richard Allen, had been anybody else, they would have been sold into slavery or down the river for the next day. Richard Allen, because he's so famous, the jailer knew him. So those two guys ended up in jail. So, yes, there's gangs. There's the Patty Cannon gang. Patty Cannon was a woman who lived on the Delaware-Pennsylvania border, and she trained all her boys to go and steal little black children. There was George Albertoli in 1851. And he was put into the Eastern State Penitentiary for, you know, stealing black people and selling them into slavery. So, Yes, this is a lucrative business. To this day, you know, we call people who do that kidnappers because of that was their big thing. Not really to grab a big, grown black man because, you know, he might have a gun, a knife, anything. But a little black child?
Okay.
Yep. That's the one you want to steal. That's the one you want to take. So, yes, in Philadelphia, I have mentioned some of these committees already. There's a... Inside the Pennsylvania Abolition Society, there was a committee called the Acting Committee. And the Acting Committee would do things like when people come to town, you know, draw them in, give them some clothes and some money, and try to send them on to the next location. In the early days, they didn't even bother to send anybody anywhere because Philadelphia was pretty good until 1842. Prigg versus Pennsylvania.
Right.
Yes. Pennsylvania was pretty good in terms of a place to stop. Well, you know, except for the rioters and the gangs attacking you in the street and beating you up everywhere you go, spitting on you, calling you names all the time. But except for that stuff, Philadelphia was relatively safe until that second act came in 1850. So in 1850, at least in Ohio, people had to pay a bond to prove that they were free. And it was a super bond, like $200. So what happened was there was a new migration in 1850, and that's when people start to move further north into Chatham, into Windsor. Come on, what's the third one? Chatham, Windsor. There's a third one. But, yeah, they start to move into St. Catharines.
Okay.
St. Catharines, Chatham, and Windsor. So they start to move into those places in Canada as a safer bet. Now, once again, Canada's no safer until 1838 when that doctrine comes down from Queen Victoria, you know, in 1838 that all the slaves in all the English colonies would be free. But before 1838, there's no reason to go to Canada, right? But after 1850, that reason kind of pumps itself up, and we get a big migration of people going into Canada. Your ability to protect, if you will, freedom seekers one-on-one was very, very limited. In Philadelphia, we had a place of a Mr. Benjamin Clark, and he lived at 6th and South Alley. So that would be kind of right in the middle of the Federal Reserve Building. And he had been living there for years, and then somebody found out that he had escaped from slavery in Virginia. They brought a federal marshal, and his neighbors came out, surrounded the federal marshal, and gave him time to escape. But we see there's a cases that happened down to the City Hall of 5th and Chestnut, where big crowds try to get somebody to escape, and the police and local vigilantes just came out and just beat them down and kept the people and sold them back into slavery.
Okay.
So it doesn't always work. A lot of guys, I know about 6 or 7 people who were arrested for trying to free people who were being taken back to slavery, and they did time in our Eastern State Penitentiary.
And then you had the Christianity riots of 1851.
That's right.
As a reaction to the whole thing of trying to implement the fugitive slave law.
Yeah, Mr. Gorsuch, he was a little bit crazy, but he felt that he could come up and get a federal marshal and then go back down to Lancaster. Of course, he met with William Parker, and William Parker wasn't hearing any of that. So literally, they blew the horns to say the slave stealers were there because, once again, you know who they used to fight all the time out there?
Who's that?
The Gap Band. Excuse me, the Gap Gang. So there's a place in Pennsylvania called Gap, Pennsylvania, where Route 41 meets Route 30. And those guys were notorious around there for running around and, once again, stealing black children and selling them into slavery. So periodically, Will Parker and his people would get into these little gunfights and spats with the Gap Gang. So this particular night, it wasn't a Gap Gang. It was a federal marshal and Edward Gorsuch. But when the fighting started, Edward Gorsuch ended up murdered. His son was wounded, and the federal marshal kind of disappeared into the night. So, yeah, that's what we ended up calling the Christiana Riot. That case was actually heard in Independence Hall on the second floor in Philadelphia.
If I may, Elliot, mm-hmm. I'd like to ask Joe, when you do your tour, the question I'm asking is, where is the concentration of black population in Philadelphia? How many blocks? And the second part of that would be, what's the distance from where do your tour cover that area? And what's the distance of that between where the churches like Mother Bethel or First African are situated?
Wow. Well, as you know, Richard, it's a time-oriented question, right? Mm-hmm. So by the time we get to 17, let's just start in the beginning. Blacks are supposed to live on the alleys, right? Not on the number streets and not on the tree streets. They're supposed to live in the alleys, right? Now, some people break out of this by the time we come out of the Revolution. Maybe some people were never in it. It's very difficult. You have to go through the tax records and through the directories. Directories don't actually start until 1787. Now, a directory is what we would call a phone book. Right? So if you wanted to find somebody who was a carpenter, you look in the directory, you find a carpenter, you find his name. It would even tell you a lot of times whether he was African or whether he was Negro. And then you could, go to that person to get him to do whatever work you wanted him to do. So when we're checking these things in the 1790s, we've got one integrated section. Got South Alley, Sugar Alley, Apple Tree, all along where our federal buildings are. So from 6th and Market, where the federal buildings begin, all the way back to 6th and Vine. That was all a giant neighborhood. It was integrated. But a lot of important and interesting black people lived there.
And that's around where the first, quote-unquote, White House, or where George Washington actually resided while they were dealing with the making of this nation state. Wasn't it? Sixth and Market?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Right across the street. Right across the street. James Fortin, when he picked his wife, what's her last name? She and her family lived right at the corner of like 7th and Market. Come on, Joe. Well, he's not going to come to me, but he did. Van Deer. They were Van Deers, and they lived right there off of 7th and Market. So the colored population, by the way, they were probably part Indian too, but the colored population was all the way right into that area. Now, so that's the 1790s, right? Then by the time we get to the 1890s, the whole thing has switched, and they're squeezing us all into what they call the 7th Ward. And the 7th Ward is along South Street, Lombard, South Street, Bainbridge. And that became it, once again, kind of keeping us off the main streets, but in the alleys all up and down. And ultimately, those alleys went all the way up to like 1920th Street, mm-hmm. where black people lived, and all the way back down to Front. So before that, we lived in the spaces in between. James Fortin, for instance, he grew up on the alley behind William White's house, which was across the street from what we see today as the Merchants Exchange. So he and his family grew up in that alley right there. So it wasn't so much the hard, fast segregation that we have today in the beginning, but by the time we get to the 1890s, they're identifying the 7th Ward. They're trying to push everybody out of the Center City area and out into what we call West Philly. Ultimately, I guess it's like by 1919, they move on the Irish community right there at the Baldwin train area. So there was a Baldwin factory where the Benjamin Franklin Parkway is today, and a giant Irish German community in there. And they just moved them all out. It was like, there was riots and court fights and everything. It took them a long time to get them all out, but they did. And then, of course, they built the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. So that's part of the Chicago City Beautiful thing, which in Philadelphia grinds into our Society Hill and urban renewal and rejection and all that that we've been talking about.
So your tour, when you go, are you going through the 7th, 6th, 5th, 4th, from Market to, say, South area?
You know what? I won't make it to South. I won't make it to South. But I do like to go down 6th Street, and I call that Avenue to Freedom. We've got a lot of stuff on 5th Street. We've got St. George's on 4th Street, you know, where the walkout happened. And then, of course, if I can get down to Front Street, where Thomas Paine documented the slaves being stolen in front of the old London Coffee House. Mm-hmm. At one point, we will walk up into the backyard of Independence Hall, and there'll be a reading of the Declaration of Independence going on, bells ringing and all that kind of stuff. So we definitely want to get back down toward Mother Bethel. Yeah, we're going to make Mother Bethel with that Richard Allen statue. Yeah, we got. I can't pass that up. Mother Bethel, Congo Square, back over there where I was mentioning Mrs. Harris's class. So those alleys right along the federal line there. Come on. You can come back down. Oh, okay. Not to forget William Still's office on 5th Street, right where the Mint is. Cyrus Bustle. Cyrus Bustle, the famous baker, all the way down. The guy who wanted to be a Quaker, and you were good to be free, but not good to be a Quaker. So, yeah, just a thousand stories about the Quakers, the Africans, the pacifists during the war, the 128 families that left Philadelphia with the British during the American Revolution. One of those stories we don't like to tell in the city of brotherly love.
Which for me, you know, one thing is that when I became a volunteer at the museum, we was able to, I guess, redo the walking tour from Arch Street down 7th and to Mother Bethel. And telling that story of those Africans who left Philadelphia and those who stayed, it for me sets the context of African Americans who wanted to be American, those who stayed, like as you mentioned earlier, Absalom Jones and whatever, in spite of the circumstances. Now, when you mention about freedom, do you say that these men and women who, even though they were captives and had owners in some cases, that they were actually had in their mind that they were going to uphold this here, uphold these men to come up with this here document of independence, the Declaration of Independence, to make them live up to that? Are you, you know, was, do you think that that's what their motive?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because, you know, living as we do on the other side of Martin Luther King, we have an interesting interpretation of the Declaration. Martin said that the Declaration was a promissory note. But when you look at it real closely, they didn't promise us nothing. They didn't promise all men are created equal except you. Endowed by their creed with inalienable rights except you. It was like, you know, there was... So there was nothing for them to live up to. As you know, Richard, when you go a little bit further down, one of the reasons that they have the revolution, they say it right there, is because the king offered black people freedom. He encouraged domestic insurrection. You know, that's one of the reasons they had the war, to make sure that we stayed enslaved and incarcerated. So, I don't think that that was their goal. I think that they were saying, y'all don't know what freedom is. Y'all don't know what freedom not is, or not having freedom is. We do. So that's why we went about the business of suing in the court for the right to own property, suing in the court for the right to have families, fighting in the battlefield for the right to just exist. I mean, so each one of these fights, whether it was in the battlefield, whether it was in the courtroom, whether it was in the church, you know, with the guys walking out of the church, each one of these battles helped to define what freedom is and what freedom should be for the individual. So that by today, we've got this massive compilation of all these court cases and street fights and wars and battles that we fought in, you know, on both sides, you know, to help define what freedom would mean. To the yeoman farmer, he didn't know what freedom was. He's looking at the Magna Carta saying, yeah, I'm a man. I'm a gentry. That's what freedom is, to be gentry. Well, that's what he thought it was. But that's not it. That's not it. So it's our story, our experiences, our fight that tells everybody, or could tell everybody, what freedom really is. Now, of course, what we're dealing with is a massive distortion. What has happened is that they said, well, look, those black people wanted to be free. They were criminals. They stole themselves. So, you know, to this day, we have to deal with this ongoing assertion, you know, that every time you show up, you're a criminal. And it's all because you really, because you wanted to be free and you didn't feel like growing sugar and tobacco and cotton for them. So then suddenly, all of a sudden, you were not only, you're lazy. On top of wanting to be free and being a criminal. So it's this mass distortion that we have to deal with. And, I mean, you see it every day. People walk around and say, I wouldn't trust a black person to do this, or I ain't getting nobody like that to do that. It's like a self-hatred that has been turned on and is very, very difficult to turn off as long as you're still being influenced by all of that kind of foolishness. I think it was Malcolm X who said it back in the 60s. He said, when one group gets total control of the media, you're going to see a total shift in bias that is going to be almost uncontrollable. And we're in the middle of that shift in bias, that we are the criminals, even though we're not the people who go across the world murdering people and stealing oil and blowing up entire cities. We're not the people who do that. But we, so far, are the horrible, murderous criminals that, you know, it's just very sick. But you know, I'm glad you guys have a show where somebody can come on and say this. You probably also realize that maybe even 30 years ago, I wouldn't be allowed to say this anyway.
Mr. Becker, before we let you go, I want to ask you a question, and if you can't answer it, or if you're not sure, but I want you to give me an honest answer. And I know that you will. As a historian and looking back, seeing our people touching their lives, I know that when you look back at history, you could almost envision some of the ancestors. Looking at our struggle here, and contrasting it with the Europeans that had been our captors for hundreds of years, and looking at their methods, And it hasn't really changed. I think it's gotten more sophisticated. But the outcomes is always the same for our people, where we're constantly struggling on a treadmill, almost like as fast as you run, you're still running in place. Where do you think this is leading our people? What do you think that we have to do? It's ultimately clear to me that we have to make a decision what we're going to do with our destiny. But where do you think this is headed? It's dangerous for any people to keep repeating the same things, because history is not going to change. It's almost going to catch up to you. Where do you think this is headed for this society, for Europeans? And what do you think that we must do to change our dynamic?
Well,
now, if it's difficult, or if you need to think about it, it's no problem. But I just wanted your opinion, being a man that deals with history, that touches the lives of our ancestors in a special way.
Well, the overall history, the Western story, if you will, I like it, as Richard calls it, the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
The overall narrative is that they're going to crash and burn. The complete obsession with materialism, the total neglect of spiritualism, the individualism that causes you to stand there and watch somebody starve to death while you got a cheesesteak in your mouth. This is the Western society, right? And maybe this is a spiritual thing, maybe, but it's going to crash and burn. Once again, every society grows, reaches some kind of point, and then dies.
Okay.
This one will, too. Now, we as people of African descent, we got a number of different ways to go. I think that the most important thing for us to do is to take care of ourselves and our family. Right? For instance, these addictions that they've got going on, these flows of addiction, sugar, tobacco, opium, liquor, and who knows what they're going to invent next year. So these flows of addiction, you know, in the preamble to the Constitution, you know what it says? It says we're going to ensure domestic tranquility. Who are the domestics? How are they going to tranquilize us? And I think that this has already been going on, you know, yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum all the way from the beginning, that we've been tranquilized. We got to untranquilize, you know, so we can begin to see ourselves. We got to go, I believe, to our graveyard, you know, to understand who we are, because every day at 6, we're the drug dealers, we're the murderers, we're the killers. That's garbage. Some people are killing 10,000 people a day, but that's not on the news. So there's a certain cycle of self-hatred, a cycle of addiction, what they call it in the 60s, a culture of poverty. You know, where people say, well, I don't want to do anything because I can't do anything, because if I do anything, I won't be able to do anything. So these three things, I think, are as individuals and as families and as communities, we've got to concentrate on these things. The overall society, though, this materialism, this race to the stars, this go, this is going to crash. It's going to crash. And, I mean, we can put everything in it. Hey, remember the 401ks? they just took it to the limit, and poof. And what was gone, they said, your money is gone. So,
Mr. Becker, before we leave this evening, give our listening audience the times of those tours and how they can contact you. Any information you want to, the floor is yours.
Well, excellent. Hey, thank you so much once again. Tomorrow, I know it's a short notice, but tomorrow at 10 o'clock, at the Philadelphia Visitor Center, 6th and Market. I'll be right out in front there, and we'll start our tour. If you're a few minutes late, don't worry. Come on inside. There's an exhibit about the Underground Railroad, and we'll probably be there for another 15 minutes where we start around the town. So $20 for adults, $5 for children. We're going to be walking. We're going to be talking. We're going to be singing songs, and we're going to be talking about our stories. No place in Philadelphia is there a place where our story is not there. Our story is everywhere. So that's what we'll be doing. This is my what I call Joe Becker's Revolution. The next one I do is on Thanksgiving Saturday. Thanksgiving Saturday. So it's like the last Saturday in November, and that's the Underground Railroad in Philadelphia. So I only offer three a year. My first one's already gone. This is the second one, July 8th. Come on out if you can. I have some door prizes. And then, of course, November 25th. So once again, tomorrow, 10 o'clock to around 2. Around 12 o'clock, there's a wonderful reenactment, so come on out. And 215-878-8961. 215-878-8961. Or you can contact me on email, jobectone, at yahoo.com. So come on out tomorrow. We're going to have a good time. I think it's going to be sunshiny. And we'll learn more about our stories and our connections in creating the freedoms that we have today.
Mr. Becker, I want to thank you for your work in keeping our ancestor spirits alive so our people here can touch them, to get to know them, and hopefully it'll change our perspective on what we need to do as a people.
And realizing who we are. That's what's lost, is that they were great. They put up with everything. They got through everything. And we need to stop thinking of them as being failures and realize what great heroes they really are.
I want to thank you for being with us.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for having me. Hey, Philadelphia, see y'all tomorrow outside.
We'll talk soon. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. White.
All right, take care now.
Good night.
All right. We'll be in open forum. We'll take a brief break, and when we come back, open forum, you can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
Tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Antiquity to the present. Our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. Sundays, 7 p.m. with your host, Elliot.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here. As many of you know, last March, when it was announced that I was no longer in the Black Muslim movement, it was pointed out that it was my intention to work among the 22 million non-Muslim Afro-Americans and to try and form some type of organization or create a situation where the young people, our young people, the students and others, could study the problems of our people for a period of time and then come up with a new analysis and give us some new ideas and some new suggestions as to how to approach a problem that too many other people had been playing around with for too long. And that we would have some kind of meeting and determine at a later date whether to form a black nationalist party or a black nationalist army. There have been many of our people across the country from all walks of life who have taken it upon themselves to try and pool their ideas and to come up with some kind of solution to the problem that confronts all of our people. And tonight we are here to try and get an understanding of what it is they've come up with.
The economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that we should own and operate and control the economy of our community. You would never find, you can't open up a black store in a white community. White man won't even patronize you. And he's not wrong. He got sense enough to look out for himself. And you who don't have sense enough to look out for yourself. The white man is too intelligent to let someone else come and gain control of the economy of his community. But you will let anybody come in and control the economy of your community. Control the housing, control the education, control the jobs, control the businesses, under the pretext that you want to integrate. No, you're out of your mind. The economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that we have to become involved in a program of re-education to educate our people into the importance of knowing that when you spend your dollar out of the community in which you live, the community in which you spend your money becomes richer and richer, the community out of which you take your money becomes poorer and poorer. And because these Negroes who have been misled, misguided, are breaking their necks to take their money and spend it with the man. The man is becoming richer and richer, and you're becoming poorer and poorer. And then what happens? The community in which you live becomes a slum. It becomes a ghetto. The conditions become run down. And then you have the audacity to complain about poor housing in a run-down community. Why, you run it down yourself when you take your dollar out.
Welcome back. To Time for an Awakening, and I want to thank our guest that came on briefly, spent a little time with us, Philadelphia black historian, and one of the city's treasures, like I said before, is two men that knows about the history of black Pennsylvanians and Philadelphians in particular, is Dr. Charles Blocks, and the other is Mr. Joe Becton. I want to thank him for being with us this evening, and go out, if you're in the Philadelphia area, try to hook up with Mr. Becton. Give him a call, email him, join your tours. You're talking to one of his students. Brother Richard is one of Mr. Becton's students there.
Yes, it was. I'm pleased. It's interesting, Elliot, in dealing with it, when you raised the question about the difference of views in relationship to Frederick Douglass and Martin Delaney, mm-hmm. because I try to project the understanding, and this is something that I think that we really, when we talk about tours and we talk about historical tours, we need to constantly emphasize that this is an economy that we can develop. Our story is an economy that we can develop, but it's also a part of our healing process. Because until we can be able to tell our story in our manner, and that's from the various colors and within the African community, because as Joe was saying, some wanted to stay. to define freedom for a Western world, and therefore, i.e., white supremacy. And some truly said, this is not going to happen. Whether they said it and moved on their own, you know, or they said it and was moving in alignment with the whites who were saying it through the African Colonization Society, that, like, we're trying to get you out of here, but still came to the conclusion, we need to get out from under this. But more importantly, what was going on, new, as he said, new narratives were being formed about who we are as a people. And the question you raised, what vision do we have about the future? Not just what history we're coming out of, but what vision do we have about the future? Because, and that's why I think it's so important for us and those in the listening audience to know the history of the place that you are residing in, to know that, to go around in these areas that you may not be able to see any remnants of, but know where these people were, what they did, and what they believe, because that does inform and will inform what we should do in our future, if not in our present.
Yeah, listen, that clip that we always play in the beginning with John Henry Clark talking about history is a clock that tells our people their cultural time of day. It tells us what we should be doing. So the clock is right in front of us and is moving. So, you know.
And we can make a living off of it. And that's the part that, you know, that I think that when we talk about job creation, we talk about business development, we talk about education, we can make a living off of telling our story. And I'm convinced that people will want to come and not only hear it, but we can construct and reconstruct our communities to be images where people want to come. I mean, they already wanting to come to see us play ball, want to come to see us sing and dance.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They already want to do that. What about if we created communities where they have to come to get that, and we control that economy?
Let's take a call. Caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hey, Brother Elliot, how you doing?
Good. Good, sir.
Hey, Brother Richard, how you doing? Good, brother.
Now, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. I just wanted to let you know, brother, I'm checking out the show. I just literally, I went over here to one of the stores to buy something down in AC. I literally just watched your brother get hit by a car. He was walking. I don't know if the brother was paying attention. I couldn't believe it happened so fast. And his political sister, she hit him. And she stopped. I mean, she stopped and she was, you know, concerned and everything. She, you know, she was like in a panic and everything, you know. And somebody called the police, and the police came, and they getting the brother together now, trying to, you know, put him in the, ask him if he's okay, take him to the ambulance. I pray to God the brother be all right. You know, just go to show you how precious life is, Brother Elliot and Richard, you know. You know, you're walking across the street and not paying attention if he wasn't focused and get hit by a car, you know. I mean, she hit him pretty hard, too. I mean, she wasn't speeding or anything, but, you know, she was going at normal speed limit from what I can see. She hit the brother pretty hard, you know, and he just went right down like a sack of potatoes. You know,
okay.
I hope the brother's all right. Hope he'll be okay. You know. But anyway, like I said, Brother Ellie, y'all brother's got a good show tonight, as usual. And, you know, there's just so much happening. You know, you got that idiot in the White House over there at the G20 summit. And you see how they protesting him all over there. I mean, this guy's hated around the world. And like I told you and Richard before, Brother Elliot, this guy, white America, they gonna really regret it, because they can say he's gonna, white America never be the same, because he'll create such scorn and hatred for this country around the world. Well, after this idiot leave office, that the stench that he left this country, they're never gonna be able to get over that. Trust me when I tell you. He's going to be the downfall of America. And they had it coming. I don't feel sorry. They had it coming. You know, I mean, all the years of racism and brutality against our people, this is their payback. See how the creator book of Mysterious Ways, Elliot Richard, he is their payback. The ass that's in the White House now, he's their payback. I mean, it is what it is, you know.
I hear you, Joe.
You know, I mean, that's simple. He's their payback. Yeah, I mean, out of black number city, fall of America. He foreseen this thing coming and stuff. That an idiot like Donald Trump would be elected president to finally bring America's final nail in their coffin. And that's real, Brother Ellen, Brother Richard. He's the nail in their coffin. I'm just sitting back just loving it. You know, and this is why, like you said, this is time for us as black men and women to stand up and fight for ourselves and do what we got to do to determine our own self-determination. No longer can we wait for some benevolent white person, you know, to come forward and save us. It's up to us to save ourselves, like you and Richard preach every week, Elliot, and that's the truth, man. So, hey, that's the way I look at it, and I thank y'all, brother, for your time. I'll just sit back and on my phone and listen to the rest of it on my phone.
Thank you for your call, sir.
Thanks, Brother Elliot. Thank you, Brother Richard.
All right.
Good work, my brother.
Take care now.
You know, Richard, when we'll be talking, and the line is open up, too, so anybody else that wants to get in, you can dial 215-490-9832. It's 215-490-9832, open forum. Give us a call. Brother Richard, when we were talking to Mr. Becton, and I asked him, as an historian, that have seen our people, the development of our people, and things of that nature, and also to observe the society that we live among, and his opinion on what we must do and where it's headed. Now, he said something, it's not surprising, but he said something that that a lot of our listeners seem to understand already. But he said that this country, the society we're living in, is headed towards a crash and burn.
Yeah.
Now, we know this. The thing is, what should we be doing? Now, we've had callers that have advocated, let's get out of here. Okay, that's a thought. But if you don't have your mind prepared, now let me preface it by saying this. That's an individualistic type of thought. And not to disparage anybody's mindset, but I just want to look at it critically. If you don't have your mind prepared, then you just go somewhere else and start doing the same things you were doing here. I think that what we should be doing is what we're doing already. And it's happening in pockets all around this country where we live. Our people are preparing their minds. They're preparing an economy. They're preparing a government. They're preparing, just like last week when we talked to Brother Chiki Okua, they're preparing an education system. We've had people on here that's preparing a health system. See, those are preparations for a society that's on the verge of collapse. Now, I'm no prophet. I'm not saying that this guy that's in the Oval Office now is going to lead to the demise. I know one thing. This place that we live in is headed towards a demise. I don't know whether it's the next guy or this guy or the guy after him. But if we know this place is headed towards a demise, then we need to prepare ourselves to move our people forward. You don't want to be like a place is on fire. You seem to get out, but you're standing on the curb with no clothes, no means to move forward, and you need help. You know what I mean, Richard?
Yeah, well, definitely.
You want to be prepared. And we've seen the preparations of a lot of our people. We done had guests on the show that's been preparing an economic system, preparing, when you hear Omawale Eshetele, Zaki Baruti, and 1 million conscious black contributing voters, preparing a system to govern ourselves. Educators like Chiki Kuhn and others that have been on, preparing an education system that relates to our culture and values. preparing a health system where we can take care of ourselves and avoid a lot of these illnesses that come on us by bad diet or slave diet or whatever. We need to gravitate to men that are making those preparations. Not men that want to get involved in this government the way it is, so they can get involved and steal money to take advantage of our people. Listen, you don't have to look and see what our people are doing here. Look and see what some of our brothers are doing on the continent, some of them. They've been put in office as puppets for some of these European governments, get in there and rape the people, rob the people, rape them, you know, rob them blind. We don't need people in government doing those things. That's a European mindset.
Agree with you wholeheartedly.
That's a European mindset. If we're going to get involved, you hear Brother Baruti talking about a proportional, what is he talking about? Proportional representation.
Representation. Mm-hmm.
And codes of ethics when we get in these seats, having respect for our loved ones, respect for our people and our elders. When we start incorporating those values in us, then we're not going to get it in and do what these Europeans do, steal money, take advantage, look to line your pockets, look to join other communities against your own, work against your own communities, help other communities get into business while your community is just going to pot. We have to develop, if we know that this system is headed towards a crash and burn, we have to start developing systems to move our people forward. And no better way to do it is that if you develop an economic system, an education system, a form of government, and some type of way you can take care of the health of your society. Those are four key points, and there are a lot of others. But right. Four key points, to me, as our building blocks to move our people forward. Not just me packing my bag and running out of here. That's me as an individual. But I'm talking about us as a people moving forward. I mean, just your opinion on it, because we got a couple calls, but I just want your opinion on that before we go.
I guess at this point, you know, reemphasizing this point about from the point that you said, because those are the technical and tentacles to the system that we are producing. I think when we have to, these are what we've always produced, and whether, you know, the political and the economic and the educational and the social systems. And we have to also make sure we're clear as we're, even on our personal level, besides just what's going to happen to us if something happened, is what is the vision of what we're trying to produce by operating these systems? It's to take us somewhere, to make us, as Wade said, make us more better, right? So we need to be able to communicate that so that we're reinforcing and re-inspiring us of why we're dealing with the nuts and bolts and the contradictions and the frustrations of making these systems come into being, to be clear of why we're bringing, what's the end game for us as African people? You know, Garvey said was to make a global African world. You know, at least that was to put an end game to it. And as Joe said, it was to make it so we can be clear what freedom is. That was an end game. We need to be clear of a vision. So I agree wholeheartedly that's what we need to be doing. And for, used to go around, Elliot, and ask people, 150 years from now, and I was just looking at Black Philadelphia, and I would ask people in any city they're in, 150 years from now, what does your area look like as a Black person, as Black people, where you live, what does it look like? Some people, Elliot, they said we wasn't going to be here. You know what I mean? As you kind of infer that some people kind of say why we as an individual, you know, Now, here we're people that have been around hundreds of thousands, millions of years, and because of this here recent condition, when we're asked just 150 years from now, Martin Delaney was around 150 years ago. That's history we could talk about now.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And he said what we should be doing in a global manner. Now, when we ask the question now, some young people say they don't see themselves getting past 27. That's because we're not communicating. What does that look like? Anybody, whether you get it or not, I think they call it aspiration.
And plus, that's feeding. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
And plus, that's feeding into the European narrative of where they're going to be at. They don't see themselves advancing past 30 because all the images that they see on the television and others, and images propagated by some music genres, show our people on a death march, either towards prison or just losing their life. So they see themselves in that narrative, in that vision. We got to give our children another vision. You know, let me see this, and I'm going to go to the phones, Richard, because we had Joe Becton on and just talking about history. You know, we helped to civilize Europeans when they came to the continent to learn as students. Socrates and others tell you in their writings how they went to Egypt to learn. So by them learning, they developed a society in Greece and in Rome based on the things that they learned. But that society crashed and burned. And when Europeans fall, they fall hard. Because when they fell into what Europeans, and Europeans don't even talk about it that much. They kind of skirt the issue. But you can see that Europeans fell into the Dark Ages. What they consider, they label it themselves, the Dark Ages, to the point where Europe was almost wiped out by the Black Plague. The way they lived was just totally filthy. It almost wiped out their whole population. But you had Africans that went to Europe, Portugal and Spain and others, and helped pull Europe's chestnuts out the fire. They called them Moors. Well, history is going to repeat itself again, according to historians. I'm talking about some of our historians. European historians are never honest about the situation that they're dealing with. They always want to put a rose-colored glass or rosy picture on it. The way this society was structured, the way it was created, it's created for failure. You come over here, you eliminate a population of people that was here in the land, steal their land, bring another population over here, abuse them for hundreds of years. That whole thing is a recipe for failure. If we believe that there's an almighty above, that's a recipe for failure. The thing is, what are we planning? What are we going to do? What are our plans to move our people forward? Not incorporating his plans. I don't care. Listen, I'm going to go to the phones. Let's hear what the call is talking about. Let me grab 602. 602 area code. 602.
Yes, Brother Richard and Brother Elliot. This is Brother Marcus.
Hey, sir.
Yes. Amen. All right. Well, you know, Garvey talked about a mass movement back to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't so much of an individual moving to Africa, but masses of people moving to Africa. That would make a significant change in Africa. One or two people going to Africa ain't going to make no real significant change. But 50,000 at one time, because if you look, it's always been masses of people move, then you got change. So you got development taking place and you know. But again, there is no solution here for the Black people here in America. These white folks have encircled us. They are the mass majority. We are outgunned in this society. Even if it crash, even if this society crash, we don't have the means to even defend ourselves. These people, you know, they got tanks, the state, Washington State, they got them people up there. They got planes, they got tanks, they got, you know, if the country break apart, they could defend themselves. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
What can we do? You know, so look at the brother here this week, the football player, Kaepernick. He went to Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
He said to hell with them here, you know, and he went to the motherland. The media didn't put no emphasis on that, you know, because again, they don't want black people to think about no Africa, you know, especially the liberals. You know, look here for your solution. Look here in America. Be a Democrat. Be a Republican. You know, be a NAACP core. You know, some foolishness. Just keep looking here for your solution while they rob you of your natural resources in Africa. You know, so again, I said, Garvey wasn't talking about just one or two people going to Africa. He was talking about a mass movement of people. And that's why he went and acquired those ships. And when they saw him get those ships, that's when they move in on him. Because they say, uh-oh, no, you know, we can't let this happen. But that is a viable solution for black people, pooling our monies together, purchasing ships. And there are organizations, black maritime organizations with black men that can navigate ships. So it's a matter of just us organizing ourselves because, as you say, the bottom is getting ready to fall out of this place here. You know, and a lot of our people, we are concentrated in these large cities. And if this place collapses, how are we going to get food? How are we going to get, you know what I'm saying, because everything got to be trucked into these cities now.
Mm-hmm.
Ain't no farms. I don't know no farms up in New York City or up in Chicago, you know what I'm saying? Everything got to be trucked in. And you got to buy everything. See, you ain't got no cash. Cash ain't no good no more. So it's going to be pandemonium in the street. So I really think that, you know, one a viable solution is take a look at the motherland, because that has always been a plan of our people. That has always been, Sierra Leone was created by Africans leaving out of America, Liberia. So, you know, our people always had that back to Africa. And at the same time, we're solving the psychological problems here too, as you say. You know, because we know when you get to Africa, a lot of our people, we got to put them under arrest. You know, when we get there, a lot of them, because they're going to get out of here. You see, if this place, they go to rumble here, we're going to have to get our people out of here. So the advance guard need to go prepare a place over there so that when it hit the fan, you know, we say, all right, you could send them, but when they come there, everybody going to be under arrest. until you put them through the, what they call it, rehabilitation camp. Because if you put them in there now, it's going to be problems. It's going to be more problems. You know what I'm saying? So, but as you say, and the brother said here, he said this place is crumbling. So we need to move, and we need to move fast. Anyway, you take care, good brothers.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your call, Brother Marcus.
All right.
Let's go to 646. 646.
Yes, Brother Elliot and Richard.
Yes, sir.
So,
Elliot, I'd just like to know, how do you expect for our people to move forward when it seems like everything in our development is predicated on us getting closer to the goddamn cracker? You know what I mean? Everything is based upon loving this cracker, making it seem as though what this cracker has is what we should have. Moving forward to being in the position of side by side with this cracker. You think the Negro gonna give up loving his former slave master and still his master for what? To go back home to an undeveloped place like Africa?
Well,
you think,
I mean,
he's going to give up these types of luxuries?
Some of us will.
I listen,
undeveloped.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, some of us got good goddamn sense, but the most of us ain't got no damn sense. That's why we in the trick bag we in. You know, it's like this. Everybody talks about how, you know, we are moving forward, or it seems as though we're moving forward. But honestly and realistically, you can't show me concretely where we as the people are moving forward. Not when you have an administration that we abide by, that we love, that we believe in, and that the only thing that we think could be our savior is the so-called Democratic Party, which is nothing more than a kind of version of the Republican Party, who basically, if you notice what's going on, are moving forward towards the same generation of austerity against the planet of people in the United States. I mean, you know, look at the CBC. The Negroes, in all honesty, ain't doing nothing to liberate people. I had made a complaint earlier today on the Carl Nelson show, and the Negro called me up about some damn bill that John Conyers been working on that's supposed to gear us towards single pay. Now, I mean, listen, ain't nothing wrong with that, but don't you think with all of the members in the CBC that collectively they should have came together and put forward something to move us forward towards that type of goal instead of just one individual? Don't you think they should collectively come together and raise hell and show these white folks how what's happening to them and what's about to happen to them is because of their greedy, stinking, filthy white brethren?
Well,
but
listen,
the whole thing, they don't know how to articulate an argument. They don't know how to put forward an agenda to counterbalance the propaganda that these crackers put forward.
But
that's
Jay,
the truth of the matter.
Jay, listen. Because I agree with what you're saying, but when you say collectively, then you're pointing towards cultural values, collective work and responsibility towards your people. If these people
but,
that you're talking
you
about,
but
wait
a
minute,
right
well, wait a minute,
right there.
But
no,
wait,
no, no. Hold on, because
go ahead.
Listen, this is important. Stop right there, Elliot.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about cultural values, right?
Yeah.
Them Negroes have no understanding of that.
That's my point. That's what I was getting ready to say. That's my point.
Okay. All right.
That's my point. They don't understand that. And if they do understand, they act like they understand it, but they don't really understand those things.
Not at all.
So that's why new values have to be developed. And they will. They will be developed. That's almost like if I live in a household where my dad and mom are alcoholics. Now, I can decide that that's the way I'm going to live my life as an alcoholic, or I'm going to change my perspective and change my values. Now, if my mind is strong enough, I can do it. But if I just give in and just weak, then next thing you know, I'm an alcoholic. That continues. So we don't have to adopt the values that some of these other blacks then adopted. You can see that clearly that they have adopted European values. And it's not even European values, because Europeans, at least they try to work with one another for their own benefit as a whole. These black folks, they don't work with their own.
Other people of color.
Huh?
Other people of color. That's what they work towards.
Exactly.
They work towards oppressing people of color.
Exactly.
We have the cultural values of collectively coming together to oppress other people. What's wrong with me oppressing someone who's about to dominate me? Okay, let me make this comment. Since we're talking about cultural expression, why can't I oppress the white man? Why can't I oppress the Jew? Why can't I oppress the Chinese? Why can't I oppress these other nationalities who are going along with the white man to oppress me? What do these other nationalities see us as? One thing, cultural capital.
Yeah, but right? You know what, Jay? Listen, let me say this. We don't have to, and this is my opinion, and I want Richard to jump in here too. I don't think that we have to even worry about doing something so we can oppress other people or oppress Europeans. Because once we come together and start instituting things that establish this planet, then other nationalities and other cultures know that they'll automatically be subservient. They know it. That's why they try to keep our people from knowing who they are. They know that once we rise, they have to fall.
Oh, no question. I mean, the bottom line is they work harder to keep us divided as a people.
Exactly. Because they know that when
allow us to come together and strip. We just don't know it because we don't have any type of cultural identity. Now, who folded that? That's the problem. How do you change it? What are we
going
to do to change it?
Go ahead, Richard.
I think that what the issue is, because when we frame it that we gave them all this power and that we have been absent of doing something, I think we're, or from my vantage point, I wouldn't want to frame it like that. Because if you look at Joe Becton was on, you look at all and dealing with the early in Philadelphia or early Africans in America, we've been framing and developing a perspective. And even to gain our own freedom of ourselves. But when we do that, you hear about those laws or you hear about whether you call them, quote unquote, enslaved catchers or whether you call them federal marshals. You dealing with the fugitive slave law. These guys had prevented us from doing what we were doing in order to accomplish that, as you say, Jay, and as I said, was innate of our cultural capital, meaning our own agency. So what we've been dealing with is coming up with new techniques and strategies to protect ourselves and on our side, because recently, whether we talk about the Panthers or other, we talk about RAM or wings of the civil rights group, they came up with mechanisms to actually assert agencies when we talk about creating communities. So it's not like we've been sitting still letting them do something and we haven't. Every time we have come up with ways and we've come up with them, they've also come up with ways. Now, how do we come up with a way where they're in check? That's the problem resolution. That's our responsibility. There ain't nobody going to do that for us. But we also have to do that based off of every incremental change or every incremental solution we come up with to see if it works. And I think that's what we're always dealing with. And I think that's what these systems, even as we see them formatting, when Elliot talked about them, we have to be sitting back in our dialogue and saying, where's the weakness? Because as soon as it becomes successful, they come in at it. And they build them weapons to come at it. They don't build them weapons just to protect themselves. They already think they under protection. They build them weapons to come at what we're trying to put in place, whether we want to oppress them, depress them or not. But we know we just trying to get our own salvation.
Well, you know, they are in think tanks. They are in groups.
Yeah.
They are doing everything every day possible to not only keep us oppressed, but to keep others oppressed.
Yes.
The problem, what makes it so easy for us to be the victims that we are, is because we are too busy trying to incorporate and include ourselves into their position. We're trying to go to them as the overseer for everything, for employment, for just about everything. Other groups are dealing with them, but they're dealing with them more on a business level. They're dealing with them more on a trade level than we are as a people. Everything that we do, it seems, is predicated on us getting an education, getting into debt, and begging them for a job to get us out of debt so that we could then go and buy their so-called trinkets, a house, a car, jewelry, go on a vacation to Europe and all this and that. But listen, let me leave you with this. I got a quick one for you. You know this guy that works for Fox News that they got up on sexual harassment charges?
Yeah, I saw that.
This cut, Charles Page. Yo, my man being set up. Because I know both of them. I picked them both up numerous of times back when they were having that so-called affair. I was chauffeuring at that time. And I would pick them up. And let me tell you something. That relationship ain't what she trying to crack it up to be. They were having an affair. I was picking them up, taking them to fancy five-star restaurants and five-star hotels, brother. I'm telling you straight up.
Wait a minute. You talking about Charles Page, the journalist?
That's right.
Why would they be coming after him?
this is what happened. Back in the day, I think it was like two or three years ago, because the last time I picked them up was 2.5-3 years ago, because I basically stopped driving. The company that I was working for had a contract. Well, one of their contracts was Fox News. And then you had around a couple of blocks away with NBC, a couple of blocks away with CBS. So every now and then, I would get the call to come and pick him up. And let me tell you something. I picked him up a good 7 to 8 times, you know, and they would be in back of the limo, you know, having conversations and all this and that. Now, I've even met his wife and his kids. I've even gotten stock tips from the cat. So I've talked to him numerous times. He's a real nice guy. Let me tell you something. He ain't sexually harassing nobody. You know what I mean? He's not no Bill O'Reilly or someone like that. Yo, if he want to match you, he got skills to match you. He go get you. You know what I mean? And she was more than willing to give him some nookie. You understand? Because she thought she was going to be able, you know, to do her thing with him, and he was going to get her a paid contributor's job on Fox News, because she was coming on Fox as a contributor, but they wasn't paying her, because in the beginning, they don't pay you. They just what they may do is they may pick you up and they may drop you off. That's what they'll do. And, you know, hey, they hooked up. And mind you, you don't sexual harass somebody that you've been banging for 2 or 3 years. Come on, man. That ain't happening. So, believe me, the dude done admitted that he had an affair with her. He done admitted that he told his wife. And the thing is, he ain't the type that you gonna bully, because he's already a rich man. His richness isn't predicated on that job with Fox. He got dough. He got dough, B. Let me tell you something. I took him to his home. Homeboy is living that Negro P Master's life, man. You know what I mean? That's just the thing that's so funny is, here it is. This is a white woman. Now, she, if you look at this white woman, you can really tell she don't really have no type of interaction really with black folks other than, you know, homeboy hitting it. You know what I'm saying? He had his jungle fever thing going on. She had her jungle fever thing going on, and I guess because of the culture over there at Fox, she decided she wanted to come with that sexual harassment thing. But believe me, let me tell you, this not the type of dude dude that you're gonna punk, cause you know his feelings is, I can probably tell from talking to him, his feeling is, look, I told my wife, I understand what I did may have been wrong, I owned up to it, but no, I didn't sexually harass her at all. I've been banging this chick for a while, and I stopped banging her. That was it. And believe me, homeboy got a thing for them little Becky, because I seen them with a number of white women. This ain't no dude that she wasn't the only one he was getting it on with. You know what I mean? Homeboy had some. He's a smooth dude, B. Let me tell you something. It would shock you looking at him, but he got a nice personality. He's real, real personable. He's real, real sharp. He's not that arrogant. And you know the best thing about the dude? He's a real approachable guy. Because the funny thing is, the way I first met him was, my uncle was working across the street at the hotel. And I used to pick my uncle up early in the morning to take him home. And one day I saw the guy, and I said to him, yo, ain't you the guy that be on TV on Saturdays, blah, blah, blah? And then me and him started conversating, and I would see him all so often. And then all of a sudden, you know, I started driving with this limousine company, and they had the contract. And I got him a couple of times, and he remembered me, and I remembered him. And, you know, me and him just started talking, and, you know, we would see each other. We'd say, what's up, blah, blah, blah. And I'm telling you, I had him in my vehicle at least 7 or 8 times, and there was no sexual harassment going on between those two. Them two was doing their thing, bro.
Hey, Ellen, real. Joe. We're gonna see him in the news. Talk about he's a witness.
Who, Jay?
Listen, let me tell you something. He's a type of dude. I'm telling you straight up. He's a type of dude that he'll take this all the way to trial if he feels that he's being abused. Or he's being mistreated. And let me tell you something. He's going to make Fox pay for it. It ain't gonna come out of his pocket, because the guy's a real straight-up dude. You know what I mean? He ain't right for cheating on his wife or anything like that. But I mean, as far as him being the type of dude that's straight-up and wouldn't do something like that, I can't see him doing it, because I was in the car with him. I was listening to their conversation. I was seeing how she was behaving. I was seeing how he was behaving. That's not sexual harassment. I don't know if you could say, because me and you have an affair, and don't all of a sudden one of us decide to break the affair off, that now you can say, or one of us could claim sexual harassment. I don't understand that. That don't sound right to me, man. That don't sound right to me. But the crazy thing is, I don't understand why she would even place herself in a position as a white woman of so-called privilege to put herself out there. You know what I'm saying? Being number one, a married woman with kids, going against a cat that ain't gonna back down, thinking because of all of the problems that Fox News is having, that she's gonna now try and get her a nice payday. I'd like to know what her husband feel like, how embarrassed he is. I like to know how other white people feel about this type of nonsense, because to tell you the truth, based on how this guy is, I think white people have more respect for him than they do for her, because he's that type of straight up dude. He's a straight up dude that's a Negro peen, but he ain't no real type Negro peen sellout. He ain't, you know, he's just a real.
Well, you created a new category for him, Jay.
Huh?
Well, you created a new category for him.
Oh man, he just
so
he's
straight
just,
up. Well, he's is that straight
he's
up?
A special type, he's a special type Negro peen, man. He's one of those. No, listen, seriously, he's one of those Negro peens that you could put him in a room with some authentic black folk, and he won't really embarrass himself. You know what I mean? Because he got a clue. He know what's going on, but you know he placed himself in a privileged position. You know what I mean? Because I've had conversations with him, and he just said, you know, I play the game, man. I like money. You understand? As you can see, I enjoy the finer things in life. And, you know, I have some different views, but I'm still black and blah, blah, blah. But then again, he liked them white women, man. He liked messing with them. He liked messing with them snow bunnies. And let me tell you something. Every time you see him with white girl, yo, there were no ugly white girls. He wasn't in the black woman. He was in the white girls and Puerto Rican chicks. Because his wife was Puerto Rican, and she ain't that good looking either, man. His wife is like an average Mama Louie.
And Jay, it's too much. But, you know, now the challenge is, Elliot, and Jay, for me, in hearing this, and this is the first time I heard her, it still projects in the media narrative the image of, especially coming off of Bill Cosby, of this black man, even if he, as you say, Jay, has the style and swagger of a new Negro peon, of this black male that's lusting for white women, and who then seduce. I mean, it almost sounds like a 1930 narrative where the white girl said, you know, she gave it up, right? But then said that, and I'm only going off of what you say, Jay, but then said that she was raped. So, but now instead of it being in a court case, it's now tried in public media
difference. Let me tell you the difference. I'm gonna give you a quick difference. The difference between him and Cosby would be that Cosby, it seems, is a serial violator of women. He's someone that used drugs and did all sorts of furious things towards women.
But to white
Charles is not that type of guy. Black men
are black men who want white women.
Yeah, but see, there's a little different of a perception. Charles would be seen more in those circles as an accommodationist Negro peen than Bill Cosby ever will be. Cosby is seen as a black man through and through. They don't see Charles as really a black man, even though he is a black man. His whole persona is that of a Negro who love white folks and is not intimidating to white folk, that's willing to get along. His whole persona is non-threatening, whereas Cosby is a threat to white folks. It's a little different.
But I'll accept that. But looking at it, or I'm going to project, in the era of Trump, to those whites, especially when you're talking about from Fox News, they ain't nothing but another black man. You know, yeah, he got style, but that's still another black man. And that's what the era is pushing. All black men, no matter how they come, this is what they want. Therefore, this is what we need to be afraid of, because if they do, they disrupt our families. And in the end, they miscegenate our bloodstream, because those ultra white or alt whites, that's one thing that they hate in this moment more than anything else.
Well, listen, man, all I can say is this is going to be a real, real interesting case to see how it go, because my prediction is he go fight, man. He not gonna lay down and let her try the number one punk him. He ain't gonna lay down and let him try to take his money. You know what I'm saying? He ain't gonna play that game, and he's gonna make what you call him be held accountable to protect his interests and support him in regards to what's going on. That's the way I see it, and I'm gonna be honest with you. I don't think he did it. That's my feeling, and the only reason I can say that is because I witnessed them numerous times together, and I can't see no type of sexual harassment other than now. It's a situation to where as you could call sexual harassment after you have an affair with somebody and the person don't want to be with you no more and they basically cut you off, that gives you a right to call sexual harassment. And I don't know. I got to talk to a lawyer friend of mine about this because that's going to change. That's going to change something because if you're messing with a woman for 2 or 3 years, having an affair with a woman for 2 or 3 years, seeing them 2 or 3 times a week, you know what I mean? How does that? How could you claim once I no longer see you as a form of sexual harassment because I don't return your calls or I don't do this or I don't do that? But I don't know. But look, we'll wrap Sunday. Have a good night, fellas. Hotel.
Have a great evening, Jay. Well, Richard, Jay was trying to turn things into what the TMZ or one of them entertainment show.
But it does. I mean, if you know, as Jay brings it up, it does raise the question about the imagery of black men.
Oh, certainly, certainly it does.
We need to be conscientious, regardless of what the differences of the type. In the end, the imagery is still negative,
mm-hmm.
and the consumer culture who don't want that and don't want to see that. Well, it makes it no different than the imagery of the brute or that they strangle in the street or shoot, in cold-blooded view because they were afraid of them. Well, they're afraid of a suave who want white woman. Black man who could take it to the hilt as much as they're afraid of this guy, this young boy walking down the street, with a hoodie on.
Well, we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, I think we'll be winding things up. We might have a few more minutes if somebody wanted to squeeze your final call in at 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
Tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Hey, did y'all see the stuff I posted on my wall?
Nah, it didn't even show up in my news feed.
Man, I'm done with social media. All the injustice and brutality going around, and it's like they're trying to suppress our voice. We're trying to get the message out there, and you can't even share empowerment and what's going on around the country either. Mm-mm.
Nah, don't be dumb with social media, though. It's a tool, and there is a place where we have a voice. It's a Let's Buy Black 365 social network. You do anything you would on any other social network. Post pictures, videos, status updates, share resources and community news. But on Let's Buy Black 365, it's a platform for us and by us to tell our messages.
Whoa, that's like a digital underground railroad.
What's the name of that site again?
It's letsbuyblack365.com.
Yeah, I heard about that. It's all about networking, and you get points, right?
Yeah, the more you network, post, and share, the more points you get. Plus, you get points for posting pictures, sharing information, attending community events, and inviting others to network with you on the app.
Wow, that's all I need to know. I'm gonna go download that app right now.
Now, better yet, let me invite you so I can get some points. It's all about empowerment and solutions, y'all.
Yeah, that's what's up. I'm all in.
Let's do it. Let's share our stories.
Let's buy Black365.com.
That says there's a zero quota on blacks coming into the country. But it'll be a white country for white Europeans only. Now, in the Constitution, here's how the coding started working. The coding came up, they says, all the people. Every time the white society says, all the people. We the people, the American people, they are not talking about you. You are the people to be excluded. That's why in the Constitution, there's no place in the Constitution, not in one instance, does it ever mention the word slave. Never does it include the word slavery. Whenever they want to start talking about black folk in the Constitution starting out in the 1600s and 1700s, what they said is they used very broad and ambiguous terms to relate to black folk. Like those who are indebted, those who are abundant, those that specific, that species of property. To make sure that what they're deciding, and they use this when they met to form the Constitution in Philadelphia in 1779, when all the so-called founding fathers got together, what they said is this: let's not taint this document we're getting ready to create called the Constitution. Let's not taint it talking about slavery or about slaves. We're getting ready to screw over some people, but we don't want anybody to know about it. We don't leave no fingerprints. No fingerprint should be left on what we're getting ready to do. This is fact. For the first 3 days in the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, they kept the doors locked while they all debated whether or not slave and slavery should show up in the Constitution and what terms they should use. And they went out of their way to say that nobody ought to use those terms. We would use very broad, ambiguous terms. So when Thomas Jefferson rewrote the Constitution, he had to write it three times to make sure that there was nothing left in there, no fingerprints left of what was going to happen to a certain group of people. And so when you read the Constitution, it says, we the people you just had. All the people you just had. When the Constitution said that all men are created equal, they weren't talking about you. Because at the same time in the Constitution said all the people are equal. They had already classified the Constitution that you would be a three-fifths of a human being. They weren't talking about you, but somehow my people never understand that. They talk about the Constitution, what they call the founding fathers. The founding fathers knew the game. They set that up in the Constitution so that they can always track that with no fingerprints. When they said in the Constitution, for instance, that all people are created equal, they've been endowed by their God to have inalienable rights. To what? To life, liberty, and what? No, that's what it got you again. What's the pursuit of happiness? It was pursuit of property. They switched on you. Initially, it was supposed to be the pursuit of property. Nobody on this earth got past the third grade without thinking people, white folk, that foolish to come across the oceans in 3 months of sailing on a boat with barely enough food and water to live and come to the United States looking for happiness.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and coming down the home stretch. Brother Richard?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yeah. You see what happened this week, and I guess they'll be having a big funeral for the young lady up there in New York.
Right.
And just as European mindset and the way they think, they'll use this killing of the police officer to put the black community at odds in relation to the police problem and the police situation in regards to how they're dealing with the black community. They'll use this situation, and they'll try to use it to their advantage. What's your opinion on the situation and the killing of the officer up there in New York?
And though it was tragic and what happened, and, you know, a mother of three, I agree that, you know, I could see that tension as far as, in, you know, utilizing in order to keep the alert about the black community and the quote unquote need for police to be fearful. But one thing that we did notice, Elliot, was, you know how long it took before they even showed her in the broader media as it related to her being a police officer and being killed in that kind of manner? We were questioning, you know, when you looked at the press, if it was a white cop, you would have seen automatically the picture, the family, the write-up. It took 2 days before it actually moved her. I mean, we heard about the incident, but before you actually got, so it's this double-edged sword that, you know, we're just speaking about, or I guess maybe I'm concerned with in relationship to the media presentation of black people, regardless on what side, but I do agree. It will be something that can be utilized, just like they said, the 100 deaths in Chicago, you know, over that, the Fourth of July period, you know, no breakdown, just 100 deaths in 24 hours after all the other imagery about blacks in Chicago, which when we, you know, we're bombarded with this, it's just a reinforcement of the barbarity that is occurring by black people and on black people. Even this ain't a ish in relationship to her. This is not a case of black individual and white cops. And you notice with the imagery they showed in Philadelphia of, I think it was twice, where a black person was supposed to be shooting a cop, and both cases right close, you know. And again, I'm not looking for police or anybody to be killed, but it didn't happen. But one incident, one female black cop in New York, and shot in the head, and it's instant, she's gone. I mean, when we look at the imagery of it, you know, not necessarily getting into the incident, but the imagery of it. What does the imagery say? Because as Chicky said to us last week, right, we're getting a lot of our education through this, as you say, tell lie vision.
Yep. Yeah, and to them, imagery is everything. And I like what you said about they didn't put out the demographics on Chicago. I seen the report. 100 deaths over the Independence Day holiday or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the picture that they showed when they said 100 deaths, they showed a black mother hugging like a young black boy.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives you the image that all of those 100 deaths happened right. in an inner city neighborhood. You don't right. know that. They right. never said what it was.
Right.
But the images is everything. So
it keeps reinforcing. And, you know, and now with the notion of the in the era of Trump, you know, where everything is media, you know, the twits, the tweets, the, you know, the as I heard some somebody say, you would think that there's nothing going on, nothing else going on in America. But this buffoonery, but it's accepted. But at the same time, when you look at the black community, you know, it's this criminalization that you know, Joe was speaking about, the reinforcement of this criminalization, that we're naturally inherently criminals, and that's a part of the American narrative, legal doctrine, imagery, the entertainment industry. It's a constant, a historical reinforcement of the dehumanization of black people in a time when they're getting ready to snatch away all the social safety nets that they had claimed only black people use. Welfare, food stamps, healthcare. They're getting ready to pull that right from under everybody, and then say, going to make it like they don't deserve it. We got to read this. I mean, you know, Dell Jones from Philadelphia, you know, when he was talking about cultural bandits, got to read it.
Well, we come up to the end of another program, and we just look forward to Sunday to continue to work, Brother Richard.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Sunday, Lord willing, to continue on this path.